one time we were with some military folks, and they said, can you get the drone to fly through the door by itself? And we were like, yeah, of course we can. That's a piece of cake, right? And they said, we've never seen it done before. So we did it, and they were like, wow.
Welcome to Hangar X Studios, where former fighter pilot and host John Ramstead takes us on a journey across aerospace as it enters an historic period of innovation and transformation. Our guests include aviation experts, pilots, financiers, military leaders, and innovators of all types. Buckle up for another episode of Hangar X.
Today's episode is brought to you by our platinum sponsor, XTI Aerospace. They are powering the vertical economy, building a long-range VTOL, and you can find more at xtiaerospace.com. Now, please remember to like, comment, and share on this channel, and enjoy today's podcast. Hey, welcome to Hangar X Studios, and this is the place where innovators, entrepreneurs, investors come to get the information that we all need right now early as we're making decisions, cutting through a lot of the ambiguity that exists, especially today. And we have a great episode today, and many of you, I'm sure, is familiar with what's happening in the drone world, the advances of autonomy and AI and some incredible use cases, but also an entire new wrinkle that was thrown in where now in the U.S. we can no longer buy and certify foreign-made drones and parts. We're going to be getting into some details of that, but I want you to remember, please, take a second to hit subscribe. No, seriously, take a second. Just hit subscribe. We'd love to have you get notified. We have some incredible content coming out the next couple months. And also just share this with a friend. And so today we're going to be talking about with Pramod Rahija, who I met up at the UAS Summit in Grand Forks, North Dakota. And then he and I were able to have dinner together at Harry's Steakhouse. So if anybody out there has been to Harry's Steakhouse in Grand Forks, North Dakota, best restaurant in town. But and you go by Mode with your friends. So Mode, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, John.
So aerospace engineer. I was an electrical engineer, and I thought that was hard. Aerospace, I think, is like 3X electrical engineering. So hats off to you. And, you know, I also, you went to the Founders Institute and got an entrepreneurial master's at MIT. You've been in the industry for 30 years, and it led you this whole career, and we'll get into some of that. But here's where I want to start. In this season, when you started Airgility, first of all, what is Airgility, and what do you guys do?
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you, John. So Airgility, is really a focus on aerial robotics. So people, we talk a lot about drones. We're talking about drones. But traditionally, drones have been flown just like aircraft, where you're flying it, you know, through some sort of ground control, some sort of command link, right? Telling the drone what to do. Our emphasis is on how do you turn that drone into a robot? And a robot meaning now that it can make decisions. It can do things on its own. It has some sort of perception of the world. And if you watch movies like Terminator and Robot, there's a ton of those movies out there. You get an idea of what's possible. And that's what we focus on, is what's possible. And some of what's possible now, but what's possible in the future as well. So we've been on the edge of what I would call the innovation curve, on the leading edge, to use that analogy of that. And we can talk more about that, of course.
Well, yeah, and I know your initial vision, as you poured your time and your capital and pulled this team together, was to reshape cargo and logistics. And I know that you had a focus in the DoD area, but as you got into it and you did some work and you innovated, that pivoted and it got gooder. So will you share what some of those pivots were and what caused them and where you're at today specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we started the company, we spun it out of, you can see the M on my chest here, the University of Maryland. My co-founder and I were actually introduced to each other as he was working on some specific intellectual property around a cargo drone that he had a vision for. That was a vertical takeoff and landing drone that was far different from anything you see out there. And so I was introduced to him. We were both aerospace engineering alumni from Maryland. So we had a lot in common with regards to our backgrounds and that sort of thing. So we spun a company out of the university. And the initial idea was, hey, let's create this, you know, logistics cargo drone that is going to be game changing, of course, right? Now, reality set in shortly after that, said, okay, this is going to take millions of dollars, not to mention if you ever do a sort of a SWOT analysis, which is your strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. We were looking at the threats, and one of those was regulatory. How long is this going to take? And are we going to have drones flying around anytime soon? And if you asked somebody like Elon Musk, they would say, well, yeah, sure, in the next couple of years. But here we are, you know, almost 8 years later since founding the company. That's not necessarily the case. And we were just very fortunate that we discovered, just through business development efforts, some things going on at DHS through their science and technology directorate. And we were fortunate, out of 200 companies, to be picked, one of two to be picked, to be part of a smart cities program where they wanted to develop technology that could fly anywhere, meaning GPS denied environments, any kind of lighting condition. And their focus was on search and rescue and public safety type of missions, which is, how do we go into a burning building or a tunnel or a subway that's collapsed or a bridge or what have you, and fly around and send the drones in prior to putting people in harm's way.
So this is in the drone as a first responder, or is it more than that?
It started out as drone as a first responder, correct. But more than that, from a technology perspective, in terms of, well, you know, we see drones. And at that time, they said, hey, look, we see the drones on the market. They're all like kind of consumer/commercially. They're used in commercial settings, but they're just not robust enough. How do we make this more robust? So we were fortunate to get on a contract and get some funding to develop that technology. And out of that, we developed drones that could fly at a level 4 autonomy, which is pretty autonomous. And what does that mean, level 4? If you go online and you start Googling or asking AI, you'll see that there's about 5 levels of autonomy and different sub-levels within those levels of autonomy. And we achieved, I would say, pretty, 4A, which means the drone can fly around, it can make decisions, and it can come back home, it can land, it can do things based on a set of pre-commands that you've instilled, and it's going to make decisions based on those if-then statements that you've programmed. So you end up now have a platform with a lot of software built into it, right? So the secret sauce is really around those algorithms, is where it's at. And so we thought, hey, let's go find a partner to help us with this. And what ended up happening is we just somehow were able to do it on our own. Part of it was talent flow. We had access, because of where we were based in the Washington, D.C. area, Maryland area, we had access to robotics engineers coming out of the university. There's a lot of great universities in this area. And we started with interns, which then became full-time employees, and started developing our own software.
So I want to get into this, too. So as you did that, you talked about a couple of different things in there. First of all, you looked at what was on the market right now. It's a little bit more, kind of consumer focused. There's definitely some commercial industrial applications. But when you were looking at this, said, hey, we need something a lot more robust. So let's start with maybe the hardware side and then get into the software side, because I know people are going to have questions. So can you tell us about the platform that you guys built?
Yeah. So there's engineering is a series of trade-offs, as you know. And so we had to develop something that was small enough that could get into these. So when you talked about drones as a first responder, that's correct. The DHS, that's how they were thinking. Like, okay, how do we get into a small doorway or a window, right? And so if you build a drone big enough, you can do a lot with that, because you can put all kinds of sensors and payload and things on it. But if you build a drone, if you have to build a drone that's small and needs to fit these requirements of getting into these smaller access areas, well, then you have a lot of limitations, and now you have to make other decisions. So the platform started out with, how do we fit into a standard door, for example? And how do we have the drone fly through there by itself, which then, of course, segues to the software, right? So not only do you now need to design the propellers and the system to be able to fit through that, that was one aspect, a big aspect of it. But how do you fit all these things that need to go on the drone to make that autonomy happen? And what do I mean by that? Computational boards, right? You've got to fit enough computational power into the drone. Again, if you have a big drone, much easier. You can just slap a board on and it there's not a whole lot of weight, but size, right, weight, and power now really start to matter when it comes to smaller missions. And when I say smaller missions, again, talking about going into buildings and urban canyons being cities where you're going to lose GPS because you're around a lot of buildings or around a lot of structures, or even in the woods,
or even if you get deep into a building, right? The GPS signal is not as accurate, and so when I'm flying, I have a little a special GPS. It's always within a meter, right? I'm flying, but you know what? If I'm plus or minus 3 feet for a drone going through a door or trying to figure out where to go down a hallway, you're not going to accomplish the mission.
Correct.
So it's going to have to combine that with sensing its environment.
Right. That's right. And the other thing that I think has advanced quite a bit in the last few years is the command control and, mesh radios that allow you to go much further and around corners and things like that, where, maybe 7 years ago that wasn't the case, and it was much more difficult. So things are certainly improving. The Moore's law that we all know for computers is also happening in the drone world and other places in robotics as well.
Now, did you guys bring helicopter technology into this design?
So the initial design that my co-founder had come up with while he was at Maryland was around using sort of a helicopter-style swash plate on the blades that would allow a transition from vertical flight to horizontal flight, right? So going and flying like an airplane. First taking off like a helicopter and then flying like an airplane. However, as we don't employ that currently in our current platforms. However, we do employ what we would call thrust vectoring. So you rotate your booms or your nacelles, so to speak, on an aircraft that you would be familiar with. They rotate so that you now have that same transition, but it's a little bit simpler. And so we have IP and patents around that sort of technology specifically for drones as well.
Well, and I'm guessing if I launch that from my command post or close to a building, it allows me to have that velocity to go either to distance or get to where I need it as quickly as possible, and then act like a traditional drone going slow. Designed it that way?
Yeah, so the thrust vectoring gives you several benefits. One of the biggest ones is the fact that the aircraft can become a gimbal itself. So if you look at a traditional quad drone, it's going out on a mission with the camera or whatever, doing ISR and intelligence or surveillance or reconnaissance or what have you. It needs to have a gimbal so the gimbal can allow the camera to rotate and get the intelligence and data that's required. However, the technology we've designed allows the drone in itself to become a gimbal, so you don't need that extra weight and complexity, and in some cases even another payload operator. in some of these instances where you need somebody that's operating the gimbal as well, or even just extra training and specialization on that, you don't need to have that anymore.
So have you found in practicality this makes it easier to use and
yes
for the operator?
It does, yeah. So you can have one single operator that can do all of it versus typically, again, it depends on the situation, but in some instances you have multiple operators, one doing the payload and one doing the aircraft. And then if you blend in the autonomy that we were talking about before, again, the autonomy allows you to have minimal human in-the-loop input, right? You don't need multiple operators. So we go back to if you look at historically, drones have been around for a long time. And if you look at like the Predator, for example, which is a great, well-known example of a military drone or a remotely piloted vehicle, it requires a crew of a small group of people, 8 to 10 people, to actually get this thing in the air and keep it maintained and all that. The idea here with autonomy is that you just have one operator that's literally pressing buttons and can learn to fly the drone in a matter of minutes versus weeks and weeks in some cases, again, weeks of training. I know we've spoken to many Ukrainian operators who are flying around FPV drones and things like that, and it can take 6 weeks to 2 months to train somebody properly, and then maybe even a month beyond that to get them really proficient. So the idea with the autonomy is that it just allows you to be able to operate in very little training and get out and actually get the mission done and do it with minimal team as well.
Hey, Mode, early on, you guys realized that autonomy in AI was going to really be the killer app here, right? Make a better platform, which you just talked about, but then I have to pair that. So talk to me about what are those design principles that have driven where you've gotten to now with being at 4A, and I know you're moving past that.
you know, as mentioned earlier with our DHS work, being able to do these things and getting to these tight spots required autonomy, because otherwise you would need a super skilled pilot to be able to do these things. And if we look at what's out there on the market today in terms of platforms that are very autonomous, there's not a lot out there. However, as you just mentioned, there's a lot of companies working on this, so there's a lot. I would say, you know, the key is the sensor fusion. The future is hybrid sensors. It's not just vision or just LiDAR. We happen to be very good at LiDAR because that's a primary sensor that we deploy that allows us to do a lot with autonomous navigation as well as mapping and decision making with that type of sensor. But there's no one sensor that just gives you everything you want, right? So us and the companies that are out there, so we see competitors out there that are really focused more on vision, for example, vision sensors. And that's great. And they can do certain things, but then there's also limitations with that. And the best analogy I can give to an audience, you know, from a perspective of what people know is, if you look at what's out there in terms of self-driving cars, you've got Teslas. And if you've ever seen Waymo is the self-driving taxi. And they're in like probably 10 markets now, I think, with San Francisco and I think Texas and Phoenix being the biggest ones, Austin, Texas and Phoenix. They employ 3 different LiDARs, about 11 cameras. And it's probably proprietary how many of them. So I'm guessing it's about 11 or 12 cameras and radar. And they have all these different sensors on there, and they are the most successful so far when it comes to self-driving cars. You know, if you look at Teslas, which I have one and I love the car, but it's purely vision-based. So there are limitations, and there are certain things that you have to be careful for. It's more like a good airplane autopilot is what it is right now. But so it's not quite there, but it's getting there. And I'd say circling back to the drone world, same thing is happening, you know, in the drone world is people are employing and they're learning how to use sensors. And, you know, integration is a key when you have multiple sensors. And there's so many things that you have to really be focused on. Like, for example, power. You start putting a bunch of things in your drone, it's going to start using all the power, right? So you have to figure out, how do I do that? And then heat gets generated. How do I mitigate the heat? So a lot of engineering challenges that come with all of these things as well.
Okay, so I'm thinking of the sensor fusion, and you have LiDARs, maybe there's optical, there's whatever sensor fits the mission the most, but you have now all this data coming in, and you're going to have to look at this data and use this data to then make decisions, either autonomously or feedback to a human in the loop. And what was the process to create that part of it? That's fascinating.
Yeah, I would say so. That is still, you know, that's still a challenge that's in the drone world, in that economy, in that world right now, which is how do I take all this data and actually do something useful with it, right? If you look at the very simply drone warfare, the answer is really simple. How do I stay alive, and how do I get, you know, how do I take out my target, right? That's really simple. But when you get into the commercial sector, and you start thinking about drones being used in industrial applications, that becomes a little more challenging, right? Because now you're inspecting a pipeline or a cell phone tower or what have you, and you have all of this data, just as you know, so accurately described. How do I take that data and use it so that next time I do this, I do a better job of it? So predictive analytics, right, becomes important. And I think that part is still very, it's an opportunity space, to be frank with you. There are companies out there doing it. I'm not saying there aren't, but I do feel it's an opportunity space also, because taking that data, putting it into a visual format that's useful for either the human operator on the loop or somebody that's actually post-processing is also very important. And so a number of tools get added on to do that, right, in the post world. What we have focused on, however, we haven't focused on that piece of it. We focused more on the edge. How do we get this data on the edge real time and not have to look at it later? Because later is fine for a lot of commercial applications, but it may not be fine when you're at war.
Well, you know, later, you know what, if you have an active shooter, or I have a big building fire, or there is like a gas main exploded in the neighborhood, and I got to know where to send paramedics and first responders. Later, it doesn't work.
Right. Exactly. That's right.
Great. So what is the edge computing that you guys are doing? Because that was part of our fascinating conversation at Harry's.
Yeah. Well, like I said, the secret sauce is in the algorithms, but you also have to have the right hardware. You know, like there's a lot of companies out there, and of course, everybody knows NVIDIA is creating some great boards, right? And I think they're probably the most predominantly ones, but there's also Qualcomm, and there's a few others out there that are creating these boards that allow you to do a lot with a small board. And that's the key, depending on the size of the, again, going back to the size of the drone, depends on the mission, right? And the mission space, what you use and what type of hardware you use and things like that. However, there's still that component of, well, how do you make the drone do what you do? And that's where the robotics piece comes in, right? The robotics piece is really around how does the software interplay with the hardware? And we make the hardware do what we want to do. And then how does that sequence work in terms of the software itself making decisions? So, you know, an example might be, you're in a mission space where the drone is out there and it's looking for certain things and it sees that certain thing. Now it needs to communicate to the human on the loop, we'll call it this time, that says, hey, I see a gun in a crowd, for example, of people in a security setting. And, you know, so it's automatically
sending. And so the processing is being done on the drone in the edge using AI, machine learning. You've taught it over time. You've practiced. It knows, okay, that's that object. I found that object I've been trained to look for.
Correct. And so that would be an example of AI training where you have a library on board, right? So you're essentially loading, you know, if you think about it in the real time, you've got to have these libraries, these big libraries on board the drone so they can identify what they need to identify. So that's part of it, of course. And then the other part of it is sending that message real time as well. And then, you know, maybe, you know, if you think about it from a Terminator perspective, if you've seen the movie Terminator, you know, could the drone theoretically make a decision to take action? Yes. So that's why if you look in the, you know, the news these days, there's all this discussion and debate around AI and how do we use AI, because you can have robots in, you know, even aerial robots make decisions to take action to mitigate something as well. Do we want that? I'm not here to answer that question, of course, but that's what's out there for debate these days.
Yeah. So once something's identified, you can either, you have a lot of options at that point.
Sure.
Right. And the interesting thing is what you're saying is whatever those options you might or might not want are going to be available,
right?
At some point,
that's right.
Well, like one of the drones that we, I saw the demonstration the other day, but it's in schools for, you know, when there's somebody threatening kids, and you send the drone and it sees it, then it locks on them and it's just a big weight. It flies into them as hard as it can and tries to just take him out from just being hit really hard. And then there's another one behind it that actually has something that's much more kinetic in case, you know, there's still a threat. But, you know, those are decisions in an isolated environment. But if somebody's in a crowd, that's going to be different.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, everything just depends on the mission scope, right? What is, as we call in the, you know, CONOP, what is the operation that you want to achieve? And so there's no one drone that's one size fits all in the drone world, right? So, you know, we've been talking about our small drones that we're doing these things, but we also have, you know, a large platform that's carrying lots of weight and, you know, can be used for tactical resupply and logistics and things like that. So, you know, we've gone full circle to some extent from where we started.
Right? Yeah. You know, when it comes to autonomy and AI and everything you just talked about, what's the biggest engineering challenge that you and the team had to solve?
That's a good question. And I don't know that there's any one answer, but I will say that sometimes as you tackle a challenge of getting a drone flying, there can be many things that come up along the way. And it could be whether it's autonomous or whether it's manual, either way, there's a lot of bugs and things that you don't realize until you actually go and flight test. So in theory, when you create something and you CAD it and you build the software and you bench test, right, you're doing it on your computer or everything, so it works fine. But when you actually go and fly it is when you discover truly, does it work as intended? And so many things can come of that where you don't initially know the answer. So that's sometimes the biggest challenge is like, let's go fly something. And then you go fly it and you realize that, wait, that didn't work as planned. We need to go fix this or that. So one of the things that we find is that the faster you can iterate, and I think this is, you know, almost obvious, but the faster you can iterate, the faster you'll get to market and actually get something out there that somebody can use. So iteration and iterating fast becomes a very important part of engineering as well. But I'd say, you know, one of the biggest, just, you know, to answer your question more directly, probably the collision avoidance way back when we were developing some of that was a big one, because you've got to make sure the drone's going to be able to, you know, get close to something and not hit it, right? Go through a very narrow doorway and get really close to those door jams and not hit it, right? So that's a huge challenge. In fact, I remember one time we were with some military folks, and they said, "Can you get the drone to fly through the door by itself?" And we were like, "Yeah, of course we can. That's a piece of cake, right?" And they said, "We've never seen it done before." So we did it, and they were like, "Wow, okay, right?" So even just having a drone, you know, be able to say, "I need to go through that space. I know that there's things around me. I can't hit those things, but I got to get through. I'm going to find a way through." That's very challenging.
You know, talking to a lot of drone operators on the operator side mode, you know, DJI, something they're really good at is the command control with their drones, even when there's interference, flying around towers. You know, the drone is a first responder. You know, this could be a real concern. I can't lose comms with that drone. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, mesh radios before, but how does your platform hold up in an environment with a lot of interference?
Yeah. So traditionally, as I mentioned, we were going into spaces that were, you know, kind of austere and dirty, dark, dangerous, we'll call it. And you didn't have necessarily that sort of interference. You had other types of interference like walls and things, but you didn't necessarily have EMF and things like that. But overall, I would say they hold up pretty well from what we've seen so far. You're just giving a very sort of generic answer. I know that is, but yeah, it holds together pretty well. You know, from what I've seen, and it also depends, I think. I think the mesh radios and the type of equipment you use do matter as well. We're using, you know, some pretty heavy duty things in some of our missions. So I think they work pretty well from what I've seen so far.
Let me ask you this. If you're kind of looking out there and you're looking at some of the, you know, the people you're talking to, either you've inked the deal or you haven't, but what are some of the most compelling use cases where you want to see this thing deployed?
Yeah. So we have two right now that I can, you know, I can talk about in the general sense that we're working on. One is around a relatively heavy payload, we'll call it a Lego style drone, that is something that can be quickly assembled in the field, put together, put a variety of payloads on, and it's attritable. So purpose built sort of attritable system, and we'd like to see that you know, really take shape. It's getting some good traction right now, I'll call it, and it's taking shape.
Can you say what the payload's going to be?
Yeah, it's about 5 pounds.
I mean the weight, 5 pounds, okay.
Yeah, and then we have another...
You know, here's an interesting stat for you.
Yeah.
From 2 years ago, the Navy has a CASREP, casualty report. It's something, a critical thing is broken on an aircraft carrier or Navy ship. There was 3,200 CASREP missions, and they're all done by Blackhawks and Ospreys, because I have to get that part out from somewhere.
Yeah.
Could come from Philadelphia to the shore to overseas. And
right.
I think it was 96% of those CASREP parts were under 5 pounds.
Wow.
Think about that.
Yeah. Well, that lends itself to what I was going to segue into next, which is sort of logistics and resupply type, tactical resupply type of missions, which we have a bigger platform that was developed with some funding from the DOD, or we call it, I guess, the DOW now, the Department of War now. And so we had some funding that helped us develop some very, again, using some of our, all of our things we've talked about, all of our technologies around thrust vectoring and even some of the AI and autonomy piece to develop a tactical resupply that can lift up to 100 pounds and fairly decent volume, and can be used in a variety of type of missions as well. So going back to your question about, you know, the traction and what we're seeing and what we believe is you know, a good future, those are two things that are the main focus areas for us right now.
That's awesome. So, you know, Mode, as you grow, you're an entrepreneur, you're a CEO, right? Companies like yours always need capital. In addition to that, what are something you're looking for? A partnership? You know, like, hey, this is something we're looking for, somebody maybe better in a certain area. Is there anything maybe us sure. and our whole audience can, you know, help you with?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking. So nobody really can do this alone. There's no one. I haven't seen yet a one company that just does everything. They typically do have to partner and work with teammates to get things done. So we're always looking for collaborations, and we're seeing much more of that, right? And you know, to your question about asking the audience, yeah, if anybody's out there looking to partner with a great aerial robotics drone company that can help you achieve something you're trying to achieve, we're always open to that. We're open to being subcontractors as well, and you know, being part of your team if you've got something going on that where you're the prime. Where we love to chat and see where there could be some synergies. So there, you know, there's companies out there that have great technologies around other types of software, or even autonomy, like we talked about. There are other companies doing just pure autonomy, and it's not necessarily tied to a drone, that want platforms to put their things on, right? And we're open to that. We're somewhat agnostic to that as well. So yeah, thank you. Those are really great introductions for us.
Yeah, and I'm guessing when BV loss and, you know, Part 108 eventually is passed, how does a platform like this fit into that now new expanded drone environment?
Yeah, so, you know, the type of drone I just described is really a perfect fit for a lot of logistics types missions. So while a lot of consumer type of missions get in the news, like delivering, you know, Walmart or what have you, or Amazon delivering things, I think really where the money's at and where things are really going to go initially, at least, is really going to be around cargo, medical supplies, things like that, that they need to get there. Obviously in rural areas, consumer drones are going to, you know, be a good fit, I think. But I think right now, if you look at what Amazon, FedEx, UPS, they're using, you know, caravans and large aircraft and rotary in some cases, you could see probably drones like the one I'm describing that we have that could replace some of those things and cut the costs of delivery quite a bit. So that's where I see a lot of that going once we see these things start to take shape with Part 108.
Well, I love that. So here's my final question for you, Mode. So as things mature, Airgility succeeds, your vision's been, but you know, it's this legacy's been created. What does that make obsolete?
I think, well, that's a great question. And I think a good answer that that immediately comes to mind for me is the drone, and some people in the audience may not want to hear this, but the drone operator as a pilot is no longer necessarily needs to be a pilot. They just need to be an operator, and they can operate the drone and the payload and be proficient at that. And, you know, I think if you look at manned pilots, and we go back in history, and, you know, if you think about it, aviation, manned aviation hasn't been around that long, right? It's 120 plus years or so. There was a lot of skill involved in being able to fly an aircraft. And I think initially, as drones have taken shape, especially FPV drones, you still needed that skill. And we can see that in the Ukraine conflict and other places. But I think as we get into the next 5 to 10 years, that becomes obsolete, and we see much more, hey, I'm an operator and I press these buttons and things happen, versus so much more human on the loop type of activity is what I see.
Yeah. So people become more of a manager of a system versus an operator of a system.
Absolutely. And you see that even in manned aviation, in complex heavy jets and things like that. The pilot, while the pilot still has to be skilled, as a stick and runner pilot, But they also have to be very proficient as a manager. So that's a great way to describe it.
Yeah, because, well, in an airliner, you know, if the system fails, you got to take over. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not saying that you all the pilot skills are going away. It's just not going to be as important as it once was, as it is right now still.
So. Yeah, love it. Well, we need to get together again soon. Next time you're in Denver, I know you're out here now and then. Let's get together in person. Let's do something here in the studio. And Mode, great to have you on, and I'm so glad I met you up in Grand Forks at the UAS Summit.
Likewise. Thank you, John, for having me.
All right. See you, buddy.